And when I hear that, I just implode a little bit because if your culture is dependent on your office, you don't have a culture. You have a space that you need to justify.
This is Leaderful, where we give you the models and the frameworks, the strategies and the skills that you need to drive true transformation for yourself, your team, your organization, and the world. Welcome to the show. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Leaderful Podcast. My name is Jeff Coulard. I'm the co-CEO and Director of Learning and Development here at the Ally Co. And today I'm really excited to introduce you to a guest. Grant Dermay is the Manager of People and Culture for the Canadian Banking Association, and he has a deep expertise in all things digital learning and instructional design and leadership and human resources and building culture from a wide range of roles, everything from McLean & Company to the Canadian Deposit Insurance Corporation to the Canadian Medical Protective Association. So working with multi-stakeholder groups to figure out how to best deliver and execute on learning and development and talent management and some of these really important topics. Today, we dig into ways in which we should be approaching learning and development in this hybrid work world, as well as we dig into return to the office and some of the debates around that. We talk about some of Grant's journey in his own learning and development. And overall, we have a great positive kind of solution focused conversation, which is important because I think, you know, last episode, if you happen to listen to episode that came before this one, I went on a little bit of a rant, honestly, about the state of leadership and learning development in the world, because I think we can do it a lot better. In fact, I know that we can do it a lot better. And Grant and I dig into some of that. And so wonderful conversation with Grant. I hope you enjoy it half as much as I did, and make sure to connect with him on the internet, on LinkedIn. I'll have links to his profile. You can check him out and follow along because he's talking about and sharing really important and really helpful information. So without further ado, let's go. Grant, welcome to the show and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, there's lots of things that I think we could dig into today and your expertise. I'll start with your expertise, which I know is in the learning and development space. You've had a variety of roles in that space, different kind of positions you've held and insights that you've gained through that process into the learning and development ecosystem. And let's maybe start there. What do you see? Like, what are some of the current challenges or opportunities that you see in the learning and development space in most organizations that you're familiar with or that you work with?
There's a few that you need to be aware of as far as potential roadblocks. Something that I find is that while organizations will promote their learning and development activities, the level of emphasis that comes from staff in participating in these programs may not be aligned with what company is providing. So people participate not necessarily to learn, but participate because they're told to. Mm-hmm. So that impacts the learning environment pretty heavily. Also, coming out of 2020-2021, what role does digital learning play in a corporate learning ecosystem? And a lot of companies hastily ran towards an e-learning, towards a digital learning, because they felt that they needed to, but they didn't take the time to fully flesh out what that strategy looks like. If we think about 3-4 years ago, in-person learning had a lot of trial and error, where it got to a point where people understood how to best create a learning environment in that in-person space. And that same attention wasn't shown to digital learning spaces. So naturally, people felt that they didn't want to participate because it wasn't the same experience. And it's funny, there's a lot of research out there that shows there's no statistical significance between learning outcomes in person versus online. There's some issues. Oh, go ahead.
Interesting. Well, I was up, you know, I might hit the pause button occasionally and dig a layer deeper. Is it that's really interesting to me? That kind of flies in the face, I think, of probably what a lot of trainers, you know, I'm on the training side of things, kind of think about is that in person is more effective. And I don't believe that anymore. You know, I've had enough time on Zoom and I've seen impact in the digital space. It does come down to the type of experience, how it's designed, you know, the engagement of participants, all of those, you know, there's lots of factors at play outside of just whether it's live in person or whether it's, you know, pre-recorded, those types of things. But what are learning outcomes actually looking like these days? Like that, are those, that statistical significance, like, are we like, how effective are our learning and development programs from your perspective, or if you know of any data that's out there?
So the outcomes, it depends on how formal and structured the learning experience is, because if you're doing a back of the envelope conversation based, the outputs may be more qualitative versus quantitative as far as assessing outcomes are concerned. But something that I find is a lot of companies approach learning as a one and done. So they think because you've gone through the training once, that's fine. Failing to acknowledge the forgetting curve, where at the end of the day, if you're not reinforcing the content that somebody went through, they're losing upwards of 80% by the end of the week. So it's the approach, not just what are you doing in classroom, but also out of classroom, is where you're really seeing those results and seeing those changes in behavior. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, we talk about kind of three design principles that guide a lot of our work on the front end, is this idea of, you know, team-based as opposed to individual learning. So we can talk about that and get your perspective on it. But what you're talking about for me is the second principle that we have, which is this like real world ready, like real world, real time.
Yeah.
Like it has to be contextualized and it has to be practiced in the context in which that skill is applied, as opposed to, you know, I've been through lots of trainings, I'm sure you have, where like here's the case study from 20 years ago and let's talk through this case study, or think of a time when it's like, well, how about like what's happening right now and how does this apply to me, and how do I use it in that more of a real time way? And so that sounds like it's a gap for you, is that kind of contextualizing the learning, supporting it for a long enough time frame for it to make a meaningful difference.
And then when we think about leadership development as a topic, a lot of the case studies that people are using are from 5-10 years ago. They're not really showing what leadership looks like in 2022, having to manage remote teams, having to manage operating in a new kind of normal. Mm-hmm. And the skills that were beneficial to leaders 5-10 years ago may not be the ones that we need to emphasize today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I heard, maybe we could dig into this, because I know you've done some work around outcome and evaluation work as it pertains to learning and development. And I have an outcome and evaluation background, not necessarily for learning and development, but through my time in addictions treatment. I came into addictions treatment as a young youth worker, and I looked at all of the money, time, and resources being pumped into this system. I was like, well, how do we know it's effective? Like, are we measuring any of this? And it's like, no, we have some anecdotes, we have some stories, we have some, you know, deeply held beliefs about what's effective and not. And I really had to push, at least the system I was in, to embrace more of an outcome approach and actually evaluate the effectiveness of these things, which sounds like it's a gap from your perspective. I know I see it as a gap when I look at training development, is that one and done. And we don't have any pre-data, like we don't have any baseline data that we're actually using to inform the design on the front end. And then we don't follow up. And then it's like, well, we're just kind of throwing money at that point in time and energy at these problems. So if somebody's listening to this and they're like, oh yeah, I need to do some evaluation on my training and development, what are the first steps? How does a leader start down that path?
Do not rely on written testing or fill in the blank, because I try not to get on a soapbox with this one, but I find a lot of assessment approaches don't teach people to retain information. They teach people to pass tests. Mm-hmm. So if you have multiple choice and it's like A, B, C, all of the above, people just need to go through and eliminate one of those answers in order for it to be correct. So is there actual knowledge transfer in these instances, or is somebody just really good at formalized testing? And I've been a really big fan of Kirkpatrick's model of evaluation. It's pretty tried and true at this point. You've got some other people that are churning out other assessment kind of rubrics, but I like the later stage of Kirkpatrick, where it gets into more qualitative, how is this knowledge being transferred into the workplace? Because you're not going to see a framework follow exactly. You're going to see how it's evolved within the system to meet the needs of the system. And then what are those results that you're seeing 3-6 months after the fact, knowing how that knowledge has been diffused into the workplace. So the qualitative is where I find a lot more value from an assessment point of view, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've we take a bit of a blended approach probably. And we don't, it's interesting because I haven't taken the step of like very clearly, like this evaluation is about this training. We take more of a holistic, like, hey, we're coming into work, and most of the work we do with organizations is a blended of, you know, there's some learning and development, but there's also some coaching and there's some consulting and there's some process optimization. And there's like all the things that are going to impact this indicator, whatever it happens to be. And so we tend to take, you know, sometimes we're diving deep into something like psychological safety or burnout or, you know, something like problem that's been flagged by through some discovery activities. And we'll try and measure that and get some stories around that. I do love the narrative approach, or at least having both, right? Having some quantitative data that we can say, okay, did we move a needle? Which direction did it go? And, but also it's the qualitative, it's the stories about the impact that really help to, I guess, contextualize the learning. And again, it's back to that real world, real context piece that so much learning and development is just missing, right? It's, and, you know, maybe I'm going to shift us a little bit, if you're okay, to talk about like design of learning and development programs.
For sure.
And what should leaders or teams be thinking about these days when they set out to design a learning experience of some kind, right? To target something. I see a lot of, so I'll just frame this from my perspective. I see a lot of just going shopping for, like you said, the one-off workshops. It's like, oh, we need a communication training, and so let's find the cheapest or the shortest or the one that works with our schedule or whatever, right? As opposed to maybe doing some intentional design. And so when you're sitting down to design learning and development, what are your steps or process, or what's guiding that for you?
Yes. The first thing that I think about when designing a program is, what's the actual problem that you're trying to solve? Because the business will typically come to you and say, we have a problem with this. This is what's going on. This is the issue. But you need to talk to people to understand if the issue as presented is the issue in the workplace that needs to actually be solved. Because it may be addressed by training. It may be addressed by formal communication. It may be addressed by a change in process. And I'm sure this is something you experience a lot. But you need to do a lot of the homework in the front and kind of front load the process where you're engaging with stakeholders a lot, talking to a lot of different people, not just in positions of authority where they lead teams, but the people actually doing the work as well. Because if, for example, you're creating a program on leadership development and there's a certain perspective of what your leaders need to do, but when you speak to the team, they're like, that's not the issue, this is the issue. There becomes that situational awareness that you need to weave into the training as well. Say, hey, I know you said this, but this is actually the issue and we need to approach it this way. So yeah, front loading is the largest piece of the process. Because once you get the topics, you can kind of go down your instructional design rabbit hole and figure it out that way, because you've already done your legwork in the beginning. So there's no surprises when you're submitting content for review.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that resonates with, you know, I think that's probably the key missing ingredient. There's a couple of key missing ingredients in there. One is problem definition and location.
Yeah. Right?
Oftentimes it's like leaders from their vantage point have seen a problem and they've identified it and located it somewhere in the system. And it's not usually with them. It's usually with, you know, somebody else that needs some training and development. And so let's go help people learn how to give healthy feedback or whatever. It's like, that might be it, but it might be something else. So that triangulation process of figuring out what the different perspectives are and figuring out what arises or emerges from the system. I think that's probably what I see most often is a missing piece. And there's a certain, I don't know if your experience with leaders is, there's a certain level of kind of maturity as a leader to be able to understand that we probably don't have the full perspective. It's actually probably the number one differentiator that we run into with clients who are shopping for the one-off workshop.
Yeah.
And clients who are like, I actually don't know what the problem is. And we need to figure that out and see, then figure out what the intervention is going to be. And so maybe that's a nudge for anybody listening to this, is like, hold that problem definition loosely, especially if you're in a position of power. Cause I know I've missed the boat so many times where I think it's this, but it's actually, it might be adjacent, but it's not the thing that I thought it was. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Let's dig into your learning journey a little bit. I'd love to know what brought you into this learning and development space. What was the turning point for you, or what was the moment in time or the experience you had that said, I want to do more work in organizational learning and development and leadership?
It's funny, because I initially, when I was doing my undergrad, I thought, you know what, I want to go to law school. because this is what I was told I want to do forever and ever. I did one of my expensive pieces of paper up here is a BA in philosophy. And as I was doing that program, I realized that law isn't really what I want to do. And as I was working doing my undergrad, I was working in a sales environment. And sales came rather naturally to me. So I moved into a position where I was training people how to sell. And that's when I realized, oh, I kind of enjoy this piece, but I want to do more. So as I was moving through my career, I would take on different projects in front of different teams, but it was typically in front of sales teams, in front of finance teams. That's kind of where my expertise sits. And then I got to a point where I thought, okay, maybe I have the experience behind me. It'd be really cool to do some formal education. So that's where I did my master program through Athabasca. And after that, it kind of opened up a lot of doors that I didn't realize were shut, where it's like, oh, I have the experience, but also the education behind my name. And now I can really make some strong impacts in organizational learning and how that kind of influences the trajectory of a business. So that's where I sit now and trying to kind of round it out from a people and culture point of view. So eventually I could sit in a space where the people function is driven by a learning first approach and how that can impact an organization.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you're in a people and culture role and not a classic HR role. Yeah. I'm seeing an interesting evolution and split in that kind of HR world around going from kind of that transactional HR component where it is. I think there's a lot of pressure in that system that drives the HR function to find the one-off trainings and just check the box, right? Because it's set up to be transactional in nature as opposed to actually we're here to transform people in the business, like through these programs and through this effort. And so sounds to me like you're landing on the more of the people and culture side of things, which tends to be a bit more, you know, human-centered systems conscious approach. Yeah.
It's a lot less risk-focused, which is kind of that old school HR and more towards like partnering with the business. So having that learning and development lens really helps out with that.
What are you most excited about right now in the learning and development space? When you look in the ecosystem or you look at some of the initiatives that you're undertaking, what's having you jump out of bed in the morning to get to your computer, you know, and to get some work done?
I think the focus on data collection and a lot of the technology that sits in a learning ecosystem, they've realized that assessment is not as mature as it should be. And it's not just what somebody answers on a test, how long did they take? What other material did they review before they answered this question? So you can get a lot more information about where a learner sits, where they're comfortable, where they're not comfortable. And it's really aligned with like a Google Analytics point of view where you're getting that customer journey. They're clicking on this, then this, then this, then this, and they're done. And that level of formality is coming into a lot of our learning platforms. And because they're seeing this data from a digital point of view, how does that trickle into in-person as well, where you're collecting similar data? It can't be the same because it's not informed by digital, but how can you evolve your assessment and evaluation criteria so that you're getting better information that'll inform future programs, that'll inform follow-up, stuff like that. So there's a lot of work in that like experience API space that I'm watching very closely. And something else that has evolved from this formality in assessment is truly customized learning experiences. Because if you have five people go through a program and three of them need one thing and then the other two need things individually, you have the information behind you that can inform a more catered experience for these people. And when you create experiences that are aligned to the life experience that somebody brings to the table, it's more likely to stick because they already have that frame of reference in their mind where they can just mold one specific thing, and not to get too deep into like a schema theory sort of deal, but they can evolve their existing experience, that bucket, and put the new information in, and it's going to stick more because they see themselves in the output.
Hey everyone, I'm going to take just a quick minute to tell you about some exciting developments here at the Ally Co. that I believe fit really well with this conversation that we're listening to with Grant about learning and development and some of the challenges associated with that and leadership in general in the world. And so the first thing that we're really excited about here is the launch of our Transformational Learning Program. It's a 6-month grant eligible, at least if you happen to live in most places in Canada, program for teams. So it's not an individual thing. We only accept teams to this. You have to have a minimum number of people from your organization attend, and it's real world ready. And so we dig right in and we bring our impact surveys or our 360 tools to get feedback about the current state so that we can do that pre-measuring and say, hey, what's actually here in the system so that you're working on something that's real and relevant to you. And it's baked in with a lot of support and accountability to make sure that we actually move the needle on these things over the duration of our time together. And we go a layer deeper than most transactional leadership programs go. We get into the right use of power and ethics and values, as well as, of course, the tactical, how do I communicate? How do I listen deeply? And how do I engage in meaningful dialogue? And how do I facilitate with my team? So some of these skills that we're talking about that are gaps in the current environment, we tackle them head on in a fun, engaging, and transformative learning experience. And so invite you to check that out or to connect with us if you're interested in learning more.
Yeah. We often kind of shorten that up to like a one size fits one versus a one size fits all. Yeah, I think most of our learning and development is one size fits all, right? Like you're going to have the same journey. I've got kids in school. They're having the same journey as their peers, like for the most part, and with a little bit of customization. But I think you're right. We're approaching this place where we can start to scale that one size fits one. That's probably been the problem, is that it's tough to scale. But with the technology and some of the analytics that you're talking about, it seems like we should be able to start that in a more meaningful way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about leadership development specifically. So we've talked about kind of learning development and some of the gaps that might exist or opportunities for people to step into. When you think about the state of leadership in organizations and specifically leadership development, what are some of the, obstacles, challenges, barriers, immediate urgent needs of skills and things that you think modern leaders need? You kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, leadership has changed in the past couple of years for sure. It's been evolving for the past decade or two. Yeah. And I don't think our frameworks, models, and tools are keeping up. I look at a lot of things that haven't actually fundamentally changed for 20 years. You know, they've got put out in the, you know, and not evolving with the times. And so where are the gaps for you when you think about that system?
I think from a leadership development point of view, it's still informed by a generationally out of date approach that sees leadership as authoritarian. And that's not going to click with your millennial, your Gen Z groups, which are now moving into higher and higher positions of power. And the values that these new groups bring to the table from a workplace point of view are going to change what leadership looks like dramatically, because it's not a top-down approach where this is my leadership style, therefore this is how we're going to work together. When I am in front of teams and I have direct reports, something that I like to do right off the beginning is have a conversation where I ask, what do you expect of me? What can I expect of you? How do we hold each other accountable to this? And what do we do if this isn't working? And that becomes the model of the relationship, because it has to be driven by the people you support, because your direct reports are no longer there to lift you up. You're there to support their development, and your success is wholly tied to whether they're performing, because it's no longer an individual's issue if they're not performing. You look at the leader. What are you doing to not support these people? And that frame of reference shift is something that I don't think people are incorporating in their leadership development programs. And what skills do you need to build in your leaders to create that comfort in relationship where they're managing 5 different people, maybe 4 different ways, and everyone's successful? So I think that's probably the biggest hurdle that I'm seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo that for sure. I think that notion of leadership as an individual sport, as opposed to now shifting to a team sport.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's, I do like sports metaphors more than I like family metaphors or some of the other like military metaphors, like whatever we're going to use. I think like sports teams metaphors fit a little bit better for me in the modern workplace. You have different roles and you have different, you distribute power more equitably. Probably like that's probably the push that I'm seeing the most, is that it's, you know, and I actually don't think that our organizations are keeping up with that demand broadly, like organizational design and learning design. Like learning design fits into this broader organizational design system. And we still have these top-down hierarchies trying to loosen up a little bit, or trying to like distribute power. And it gets tricky. Like I've worked with lots of teams that are trying to navigate this world of how do I empower people, but I'm still ultimately accountable. And I got to report up the chain to eventually the CEO or the shareholders, or like wherever that accountability is. And so yeah, it's leaders, especially middle management leaders these days, are in a really tricky bind when it comes to, you know, we're losing some of that role clarity and authority to just make decisions.
Yeah,
which is efficient and easy, right? That's probably the sole benefit of most hierarchical approaches, is it's just, yeah, I know who's going to make that decision. I can kick it up the chain if I don't think I can, right? Somebody eventually will make that call. Modern teams are different because we're trying to distribute that power. And like, actually, can I run with that? Do you run with that? Whose is this? And so, yeah, I guess I'd be curious to know how you're tackling that in your organization or in your world, around besides that front end conversation with the team to set expectations and, you know, ask what support looks like, and like having that rich dialogue. Are there some structural things that you've been playing with, or anything that comes to mind in that realm?
Yeah, I think to distribute power, you need to communicate decision hierarchies. When can somebody in an individual contributor role make this decision? When do you want to include your leader? When do you need to kick it up to the leader? And having that formally documented and having a leader go back to that saying, thanks for looping me in, this is your decision and I will support what you think is best. And that kind of creates an environment where your leaders need to trust their team, because they've hired them to do a job and you're paying them sometimes a really good chunk of money to do this job. There's no benefit in having to tell somebody explicitly how to do their job unless there's like frameworks and legislation that you have to follow, because that kind of goes back to the, what's that relationship work look like? And different people are going to want to do things differently. They're going to want to work differently. They have different process. And as a leader, you need to be flexible in that piece. So accommodating the individuality amongst the team and empowering those people so they feel comfortable to make decisions to distribute that power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you hit on it there with that documentation of new ways of working.
Yeah. Right?
We have to acknowledge that this is a different way of working than maybe the hierarchy has traditionally established or the org chart kind of has represented. How are we going to be with that? And let's navigate that. Let's collaborate on that. Let's set mutual expectations around that. And I think that's probably the mutuality piece, is that relational phenomenon, that old school leadership style of, well, this is just your job, right? Like, this is your job, just do it. And I'll tell you what to do. Like that kind of transactional task focus. We talk a lot about task versus relationship. Yeah. Hierarchies, fundamentally, this, you know, what we've inherited from the military or other autocratic kind of very linear places, is very task focused, right? Yeah. And the effectiveness and the relationship is like less important than the speed and the task getting done, right? Versus I think we're in a world where we're prioritizing relationship. It's interesting to watch the like learning development and the organizational design, and to some level, the DEI space,
yeah,
all kind of circling around this, like, what is this 21st century, this 2023 new organizational model? How does it work together? How do these teams, you know, actually fit and do the work? And so I don't even have a question in there, other than just another rambly paragraph from Jeff about like, this is what we're seeing and how can we be with that in a new way.
And something that we're seeing a bit more and more, especially with this return to office narrative, is the idea of a working preference. And we're seeing younger groups and internalized groups are more keen to work remote because that's where they feel a little bit safer. They're not subject to the existing patriarchy and how business has been set up to benefit specific groups. But in the data, we're also seeing that marginalized groups see the potential harm in working from home where they're not visible. So they're kind of protecting themselves from the system that they're participating in, but they're also seeing that they need to participate in the system in order to move up. And I think that's an unfortunate fallacy. And it would be great to see leaders kind of break that down and show new ways of working, new ways of communicating, new ways of managing projects to facilitate the idea of preference being not just in person, but also beefing up that what does digital leadership look like and how can you support a team across time zones, locations, all that good stuff. Because a lot of your big shops have offices in different places. So this idea of working digitally isn't new. It's just because now there's that work from home piece and maybe a justification of real estate and seeing companies say, oh, return to office so we can preserve our culture and really do that. And when I hear that, I just implode a little bit, because if your culture is dependent on your office, you don't have a culture, you have a space that you need to justify. And it's so unnecessary, I find, because if you're going to tell me that over the past couple of years in the workplaces I've been at, that connections weren't created because we weren't sitting in the same space, I don't think I agree with that. So how does that inform leadership? And how does that inform like working in a new environment?
Such an important conversation, and a conversation that I don't see enough organizations having, to be honest, right? You're right. I think we're in a place of like return to work because of culture. And you see the memes going around on the internet with like pictures of cubicles or a dirty microwave. And
yeah.
It's like, return to work for the culture. And it's like, the culture. It's like, yeah, true, right? Like, and this expectation or assumption that we have to be in person to make meaningful connection, I think is absolutely flawed. I think that this pandemic has showed us that. It's accelerated, I think, a lot of the trends that we were seeing in the space. But, you know, I've met people over the past 2 years at our weekly learning and action session that I have a very deep connection with and relationship. And we met virtually, right? So I was thinking maybe I'd actually love to get your opinion on a framework, a model that we've pulled together from some of the experiences we've been having over the past couple of years. And then it might be a pathway to choose a next topic. And then I don't want to keep you too long. You've been gracious with your time. And so I'll do a quick screen share here. And this is a set of interconnecting challenges that we see in basically all of the organizations that we work with to some degree or another. And the outer rim here, these six, we call them indicators of workplace health and kind of overall function, right? So we have, for those of you who are listening to this, we've got chronic burnout and deep stuckness and cultural disconnection. We've got broken communication, psychological distress, and unhealthy tension as these kind of these indicators that something else is a problem within the organization. And oftentimes, one of those is the reason why we're talking to a team or a leader. It's the burnout problem, or it's the tension problem, or the conflict. And when we dig beneath that, we see what we call misuses of power, right? And so we go back to that conversation about, you know, maybe we're using power in a way that isn't actually aligned with what the organization needs, right? And this idea of unethical leadership, which can feel a little bit punchy for people when we start talking about ethics and unethical versus ethical. What we mean by that is alignment, again, with values. Right. So are we using our power in a way that's aligned or misaligned with the values of the team? If it's misaligned, like ethics are really just values and practice. And so we have to kind of call that out and say that that's unethical. When you look at this map or this model, which one of these do you see the most of when you think about either your organization or the organizations you've supported in the past, as far as kind of primary challenges?
So looking at this, I think what I've seen the most of is like a cocktail of broken communication, psychological distress, and chronic burnout. But I think communication is that real root where through upholding silos or maintaining this perception of power, communication hasn't evolved in the same way that our workspaces have. Is if you think back in the days of everyone going to the office, and it's funny to think that a Gen Z person going into the workforce, they don't know what cooler talk is. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. But there was reliance on informal information sharing, and working in this space that just doesn't exist anymore. So how you're communicating, what you're communicating, when you're communicating in this digital space is huge. And I've been a really big fan of Erica DeWall's work in digital body language, and seeing how you can create that same feeling with your communications digitally. So things like responding promptly, making sure that your punctuation isn't concerning, and making sure that you're not providing succinct and short responses just to get something out there, because there's no context. People can't see how you're communicating the message. They just read it. So they're projecting however they feel about their performance, about their role into that communication, which could lead to that sense of a lack of psychological safety. It could push people to say, I need to do more. I need to do more. My boss is mad at me because they sent a one word response to an email, or they sent a meeting invite and didn't say why they were meeting. Grinds my gears. Like, tell me why we're talking, please. Otherwise, I'm going to decline the invite. Like, if I don't know what I need to prepare for this, I'm not showing up. And acknowledging that this is a new skill that people need to develop is something that a younger generation is more keen on than an older one, because the older one is pushing their preference down on the groups that are coming up, because they're in the position of power and they're saying in person culture, blah, blah, blah.
Speaking of misuses of power, right?
Yeah.
The centering of needs, right? And leaders, that's one of the shadow sides of power, is that you can center your own needs and preferences at the expense of the team, or at the expense of the people that you're there to support, right? And so we get that misuse of power, and it's the pathways through communication, right? And so we communicate this misuse of power, and the receiving end, like you say, is filtered through the meaning that person will make of that. And it might lead to psychological sense of unsafety or distress, or it might lead to, like you say, working harder, burning out, not speaking up, right? Actually shutting conversation down. And actually, when we think about, you know, so I think I agree with you. Communication is the default. Like, it's the thing that if we're going to work on something, it's probably going to be communication with the team, because it is so interconnected to these other forces that are at play. Conflict is an interesting one, because we see a lot of artificial harmony in organizations where leaders think everything is fine because they're not getting pinchy feedback, but that pinchy feedback is going sideways, or like it's leaking out into the system in other ways. It's just not in a healthy dynamic. And again, there's power at play there as well, for sure.
Like, if meetings are happening after meetings, or if somebody says any questions and there's none, but people have a lot to say after the fact, it reflects that lack of psychological safety. And I think you're seeing it in job seekers and what they're looking for now. And I've done a lot of recruitment lately, and a question that I always hear is, what's the culture like? And I realize in my position, I'm selling the company, but I also want to be honest with the candidates and say, you know what, we have a healthy culture. This is what we're doing. This is what we're working on, and kind of giving that full-fledged piece. Because if somebody comes in and says, you know what, this isn't for me, and they leave, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of shorter stints because people are valuing where they want to go in their careers, or you're seeing industries with really high attrition because it's not safe. It's not healthy. And look at like education and healthcare, especially in Canada, there's been a leaky bucket in those spaces, especially recently. And with teachers, you're seeing them move into lateral positions like corporate learning, but also customer success, sales, project management, because the system that they're in doesn't support them as much as what they want to do now.
That's an interesting force, I think, that exists now in the world for organizations to wrestle with. And I think learning and development is a key piece of that. I think growth for most of us, that growth and learning is, at least for me, has been a driver in my own journey, right? Am I, it's salary great, but am I growing and learning? Am I having the impact that I want to have in the world? I think, interesting, I love your take on this. What you've noticed, kind of the pandemic for me, accelerated that awareness more broadly amongst people. I think we all had a brush with existential anxiety and worry. And it's like, am I doing what's making me happy? Is this workplace actually filling my bucket and aligned with my values? Because if not, like, life's too short to like stick around here. So I'm seeing some of that behavior or that language.
Everyone had the opportunity to reflect, and the pace of job change in the past couple of years has been huge. And we're seeing it in companies releasing mission and value statements, because younger generations want to work for a company that's aligned with their values and not just aligned. And we've got these words on a piece of paper, or we got these words on our website, but how do you live those pieces? Because if there's that lack of walking the talk, you're done. Then people will just leave.
Yeah. So I guess how important is that from your perspective, the organizational, I guess, ecosystem when it comes to vision, values, culture, as it relates to learning and development? Because I think sometimes I can see disconnects there. Again, it goes back to that, like, contextualizing this learning. Why is it important? Not just to me, but maybe to the business. How do leaders approach that? Or how can we approach making sure that there isn't a disconnect between kind of our learning and development offerings and systems with the broader vision, values, mission of the company or team?
Yeah. So there's a lot more work and emphasis being put on competency-based learning programs and leadership development programs, and showing how those specific competencies tie directly into the values of the company. So one of the projects that I'm working on, I'm using a condensed Lominger approach to competencies and mapping it to the values of the company and what that looks like in different positions. Because if we have strategic thinking, but what does strategic thinking look like to somebody in an administrative role? It could be more around process optimization, because that's within the wheelhouse of something that they can fully control, assuming they're empowered top down. But what does strategic thinking look like from an entry-level leader, a mid-level leader, a senior level leader in your executive team? It's all very different, but you need to show that build. And I find that companies are really starting to pay more attention to this competency-based framework and weaving it into their programs. You're reinforcing the same message. You're showing that transparency of information as well. And it's building less of a linear learning experience and leading experience.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That linear nature, I always warn clients and participants, like, we're not on a linear journey here. Like, we're not going to just go from A to B in one smooth line. There's going to be some spiraling and some circling through these topics, as you say, as we contextualize it to the unique needs of the organization and the team, and we balance skill building with conceptual understanding and all of these different pieces that go into a more robust kind of learning experience that does have the impact we want at the end of the day, as opposed to just something we say we did, right? I've been to lots of trainings where it's like, I think the point was just to check the box on my personnel file that said, Chef attended a training this year on this topic, right? And so I think we're hopefully everyone's moving past that, but I do know that still exists in some places. And so there's lots of disruption to do there.
Yeah, for sure. And the idea of not just teaching fully in theoretical and conceptual, you need to tie these concepts, these competencies to the work that the person is doing, because that's where you're going to see the real knowledge transfer and evolution of how people are working.
I'd love to wrap with a final question or two, if you still have a couple of minutes.
Of course.
Your own learning journey, what's next for you? You've been doing some schooling. You've entered into a new role, I believe, the last couple of months. You're drinking from the fire hose, but you think of your own leadership skill, competencies, what's the highest priority for you, and how are you going about building those skills or getting that knowledge?
I'd love to spend more time focused on my generation, millennials, and what does that look like from a leadership point of view, and maybe do some research specifically into this generation, because it's getting to a point where your millennials are going to be in your positions of power. And how does leadership look in a generation that has been largely held back by the economic downturn in 2008, the downturn that's happening now, and how has that molded the organization's approach to leadership?
I'd love to close out on your hypothesis about what that research is going to show. What are your assumptions, or what are you thinking is going to is different about the millennial leadership experience?
I would love for it to uncover that leadership is a means to an end, and not the, like, people don't find their true value in being a leader. They are a fully fleshed out person who happens to lead. That would be ideal for me.
I love that. And that's going to be the mic drop moment. And so thank you so much, Grant, for sharing so much of your time and your insight into the complexities, really, of learning and development, leadership, organizational design, like all of these forces that are at play that impact that employee experience and that workplace culture so profoundly. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate all that you share on LinkedIn. And so anyone listening who isn't following Grant on LinkedIn, you absolutely should. I'll have some links to in the show notes to find Grant on the interwebs. And so looking forward to chatting again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Leaderful is brought to you by The Ally Co., a team of human-centered, systems-conscious consultants, coaches, and facilitators dedicated to helping you and your team tackle the core problems of burnout and stuckness and misalignment and misuses of power and all of the things that get in the way of creating truly human-centered workplaces where everyone thrives and does their best work. Head over to www.theallyco.world to learn more.